Welcome to the Be Yourself Happy, Healthy, Hopeful podcast. I'm your host, Adriana Grande. I'm a health promoter at the Bulimia Anorexia Nervosa Association, also known as BANA, here in Windsor, Essex. I'm thrilled to be here with you as we begin our journey of meaningful conversations about mental health, self-acceptance, and the path to wellness. Today, I'm joined by Alicia Regier, a registered social worker and BANA's intake worker. Intake workers, regardless of where they work, see the rawest, most vulnerable moment when someone finally decides to reach out for support. And with Alicia being incredibly calm and knowledgeable, she's the perfect person to be guiding clients through the intake process and answering any questions through our 1-855 number. If you don't know Alicia already, I'm excited for you to learn from her and how she guides the intake process. So Alicia was born and raised here in Windsor, and she's thrilled to strengthen our community through the work of BANA. Her academic journey led her to earn a bachelor's degree in social work with a minor in psychology, followed by a master's in social work. Throughout her research, she's been deeply invested in understanding the complexities of psychological development and disorders, with a particular focus on eating disorders. Welcome, Alicia. And for everyone listening, I hope you walk away from this episode really feeling prepared to take that first step on your recovery journey. So thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to do this today.
I know we're office buddies, and I hear so much of, you know, all the incredible work that you do when you update us. And I just think this is the perfect spot for you to talk about the intake process, because when I'm out in the community, or Marissa and I are, most of our questions are about intake and what it looks like. And so people are going to get it from the source here today. But before we get into the details of your role, can you share a bit about what drew you to working in the eating disorder field? Was there a personal moment or experience that lit this path for you?
For sure. So it's kind of funny. From a very young age, I really recognized I had a natural pull towards mental health work. And I still remember taking one of those aptitude tests in grade school, and it suggested that I do like a school counselor, things like that. And it didn't surprise me because, like I said, I always kind of had that natural pull of working in mental health. So that recommendation really, really stayed with me. Mm-hmm. I guess my particular connection to eating disorders kind of emerged a little bit later on in life. Honestly, during a period of my life where I personally did develop an eating disorder, it happened really quickly and unexpectedly. One of those things, right? You never think it's going to happen to you, but eating disorders don't discriminate. They can really happen to anyone at any point. So navigating that experience from the inside really profoundly shaped who I am today, personally, but as well as professionally. So having lived both within the disorder and on the other side of recovery, I've come to really deeply understand the freedom, the clarity, and possibilities that recovery can really bring. So my academic path, it really allowed me to channel this personal experience into meaningful purpose or professional work. And throughout my master's social work program, I focused a significant portion of my coursework and research on understanding eating disorders, how they develop, how they impact individuals and families, what evidence-based strategies support healing. And then kind of combining that training with my own lived experience has really given me a nuanced understanding of the complexities surrounding eating disorders, and also the importance of compassionate, individualized interventions.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that, Alicia. I don't think many people would know that. So I think it's, you know, like I said at the beginning, intake is just such a vulnerable moment for people. And to have your expertise professionally, like clinically, and, you know, that lived experience, it's no wonder people feel so comfortable with you and talking to you. So thank you. Can you tell us a bit about your specific role in intake, and what is the ultimate goal, really?
Yeah, so you kind of mentioned earlier, usually when people are coming into intake, that's like their rawest, most vulnerable point where they've decided to reach out for help. So my role is really to be like that first point of contact for someone and speaking with them, gathering more information, and what we might call a psychosocial assessment. So this really lets the client and I speak about their eating behaviors, mental well-being, their medical safety and support system. It also helps determine maybe what level of care might be best appropriate for the individual. So that could be things like an outpatient setting, inpatient setting. There's a lot of factors that really play into it. So having a robust assessment is really crucial. And then kind of as we progress during the intake process, I'll additionally explain kind of how the programs work, what next steps look like. And then beyond all those logistics, again, the ultimate goal is really to make that first interaction feel really safe and validating in that vulnerable moment. So calling for help with an eating disorder can take an enormous amount of courage. I think there's a lot of shame and stigma attached to them. So people are genuinely feeling a little bit nervous when they first reach out. So my goal is really for people to feel heard, respected, understood. And it is just so important that that client leaves the conversation feeling like they're no longer navigating this experience alone.
Yeah, that's a big job, but
Yeah,
we're
yeah.
lucky to have you, you're doing it. So how long is the assessment actually? Like with you, that first intake appointment, how long would that be?
Yeah, so that psychosocial assessment with me takes roughly about 2 hours. I find 2 hours is usually the standard amount of time. Depending on the individual, we can get through it a little quicker. Sometimes we might have to book another appointment to finish it, but 2 hours is usually that sweet spot.
Thinking about, someone who's unsure of what to expect, they would come to the appointment. They could come with a friend, technically, like the friend could wait in the waiting room for them. They would fill out some paperwork while when they get here and then proceed to their appointment.
For sure. And I always encourage folks like bring some things that might make you comfortable. If you have, I always will offer water, fidgets, things like that. But if you have anything, right, we're going to be talking about some pretty big topics. Sometimes these people may have never even talked about them before. So whatever makes you most comfortable, you can bring it into my office. No judgment. Just whatever is going to help you in this moment.
Okay, that's great. So when someone does finally pick up the phone to call Banna, what is the most common emotion you hear on the other end? Because you do answer a 1-855 number. Is it fear, relief, or maybe something else going on?
So it's often honestly like a mix of emotions. Most common, I would say, maybe some ambivalence. Some people are calling, they're usually a little bit nervous, but also relieved at the same time. So many callers might feel nervous about maybe being honest or unsure. A really big one I hear is unsure that their struggles are even serious enough to be calling. So I often hear folks expressing the belief that they don't think they're sick enough. At the same time, there's often a sense of relief from just saying out loud to someone who understands. So sometimes the call can even start a little bit hesitant, but then once we get talking, we kind of build that rapport a little bit. By the end of the conversation, you can hear that shift of sounding maybe a little bit lighter because they've taken that first step and again, aren't navigating this alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it typically a person experiencing behaviors calling, like they themselves are concerned that they have an eating disorder? Is it a family member who's usually calling you?
Honestly, I would say it's a pretty equal mix. I hear a lot from people themselves that are wanting to know maybe how to navigate services, having resources, and then family me. So a lot of parents giving me calls about their teenagers, ch children, things like that, as well as just other support people in people's lives. That could be friends, coworkers, things like that, that are kind of maybe having concerns about people in their lives and just wanting to know some information. And again, maybe some resources that I can provide them and give them some guidance on how to have that conversation.
For people who are listening who may not know, Banna is a centralized intake point. So even though Banna, the clinical team here, may not see children and teenagers, everyone still calls you, and then you kind of take it from there. So yeah, you do get a wide range of people for sure. Okay, what is the biggest misconception people have about what happens during an intake visit? Do they think they're going to be interrogated or judged, or what is it?
Honestly, I would say one of the most common concerns people bring into the intake appointment is that fear that they'll be judged. I always kind of say that I'm here to help, not judge. So when people are fearful of being judged, whether it's like their eating behaviors, their body, or again, whether they're sick enough to deserve care, I'm here to help. So in reality, the purpose of the intake is quite opposite than judgment, right? It's collaborative, it's exploratory. We just want to have a conversation. As an intake clinician, my role is really to understand that person's experience in a holistic way. So what they're going through, what challenges they're facing, what types of support might most be helpful for them. So the questions, again, they're not about judgment. They're about ensuring that we can connect someone to the most appropriate level of care and resources. The more and better I can understand you, the more I can help with treatment planning, connecting you to resources. And judgment is never the purpose of why I'm doing an assessment.
I'm just, as you're saying that, I'm thinking that, not obviously not everyone who needs support but still comes for an intake will pursue treatment and recovery. Like, what's the biggest barrier from like intake to getting them into either outpatient or the intensive outpatient? What's that barrier for most folks? Or maybe there are a couple.
Yeah, so barriers often include, I would say, one, we're having a grocery crisis right now in terms of prices. A lot of what the treatment includes is what we would call mechanical or regular eating. So that would look at having three meals, two snacks a day. That requires us to go to the grocery store and buy groceries. And the cost of living right now is, as we know, not manageable for a lot of folks. Also, another barrier I might say is, especially in our intensive outpatient program, it's kind of what I like to explain as a day program. So imagine you're going to school Monday through Thursday, but maybe like a half day. A lot of people can't take time off work, they have children, things like that. Treatment is a really big time commitment that requires a lot of your attention, time, things like that. And sometimes that can be a really big barrier for folks that have other responsibilities in their life.
What are some workarounds for that, I guess, or are there workarounds for that time piece specifically?
So our nurse practitioner, Barb, she's great in offering, making accommodations, writing letters for work if you need to take time off. We can also help you with completing any kind of like EI forms. In terms of the grocery piece as well, we do offer gift cards for when folks are in treatment to grocery stores, maybe particularly ones that they may shop at. So those are always things to kind of help with that financial piece. We do also offer virtual sessions. So if transportation, getting to Vanna and things like that, even if kind of you're short for time, we can always do virtual sessions as well.
Okay, those are great options that I don't think many people would think about or know that Banna offers. So thanks for explaining that. I think obviously Banna is a community-based organization and the care that people receive in community is so vital. But what do you think the biggest hurdle people face, specifically in our community, when trying to access eating disorder support?
So I think with often with any community-based care, one of the biggest hurdles is really the gap between the need and availability for services. And that often shows up in the form of wait lists. It's always one of the parts of my job that I dislike the most is having to say, all right, we're done the assessment. You're a great fit for treatment and you need to wait. We're seeing more people reaching out for help, which is really positive sign, right? That awareness is increasing. However, the system hasn't always grown at the same pace as the demand. So as a result, many individuals and families may face delays before they can access specialized eating disorder support treatment. Another challenge in the community, I would say, is limited access to specialized inpatient care for eating disorders. So inpatient care, we're talking maybe folks that require a higher level of care. So maybe we need medical monitoring around the clock. There might be some medical concerns and complexities alongside the eating disorder where it wouldn't be safe or appropriate for them to be in an outpatient setting. So currently, Windsor-Essex does not have a dedicated inpatient program specifically for eating disorders, which can make it complicated when someone requires that higher level of care. That being said, there is important work happening locally. Our program is actively collaborating with Windsor Regional Hospital right now to develop a clear care pathway for individuals who may need inpatient stabilization so that people can then move more safely and efficiently between hospital care and community-based services when it's necessary.
That's really great. I remember even a couple of years ago when I started at BANA, there wasn't that clear. They were working on it, but I don't think there was anything established. So now I know with Dr. Matigo and working closely with Windsor Regional, it's a lot easier for you, for the clinical team, for the clients, right, to make sure that they're getting appropriate care. And I guess that's also what's great about the IOP or intensive outpatient program is that there's kind of like a bridge in the middle to kind of step down into out of inpatient, but then also step up if maybe a hospitalization isn't required. So
For
lots of
sure.
happening always behind the scenes all the time here.
Yes.
Amazing.
The dream would be an inpatient program in Windsor one day.
I know.
But right now, currently the closest would be Homewood Health in Guelph, as well as Credit Valley in Mississauga.
Right. And I'm pretty sure I've seen, ideas on paper about proposing an inpatient program locally, but obviously it has to be the right time with the right funding, right?
It will happen one day. I'm
It
putting it
will
out there.
happen. There you go. I love it. So with the wait list for services, if someone for our general outpatient program is placed on a wait list, what advice or maybe like triage do you have to offer them to keep them safe and supported while they wait for their first session?
Yeah, so when someone is facing a wait list, one of the first things we do during intake is to try to make sure that they still have support and structure while they're waiting for ongoing services. So that could be like during the assessment process as well as on the wait list. So as part of the intake process, we ask the clients complete what's it's a self-assessment called a LOCSA. That stands for Level of Care Self-Assessment. It is through our partner's Body Brave, which helps us better understand the level of care that may be required for that individual. And after completing that assessment, individuals are given an access to a bunch of self-led modules through the recovery support program, which they can work on while they wait for next steps. These modules cover areas like understanding eating disorders, building more regular eating patterns, body image, and really developing practical recovery skills on their own while they wait. So they're designed to give people tools and education so they don't feel like they're completely on their own during that waiting period. And we also encourage people to connect weekly with virtual support groups. I'm always happy to provide resources for those peer support groups. They can be really valuable. I've heard of people having really great experiences with them. And those spaces really allow individuals to hear from others who are going through similar experiences and to also feel less isolated in their own experience while they're waiting to begin in a more structured treatment.
Yeah, I'm assuming that validation would be really important, especially when people, like you're saying, don't feel that maybe they're sick enough to maybe just learning about it a bit more, makes them more confident that this is the right. They do deserve care. They do need it, and that, it's worth the wait to get the care that they need. Okay, so when I think of like what defines a successful intake, I'll use that in like air quotes. Is it getting them on the list, or is it maybe like even something more subtle, like a change in thinking?
Yeah, so I would say at the end of a successful intake, really, I have two goals. One, a client who feels supported. That's always my main priority. And two, having a really good understanding of the client's psychological, social, and physical functioning. So first, right, there's the human side of it. If someone leaves the intake feeling heard, less judged, with a clear understanding of their next steps, that's incredibly important. That's kind of like the basis of that client-centered care. Second, we really want to build a clear picture of what's going on for that person so we can make sure that they're connected with the most appropriate and safest level of care. So that means exploring not only their eating behaviors, but the broader scope of their care. So looking at things like psychosocial context, things like mental health, medical concerns, supports at home, maybe any stressors that are going on, and any other factors that may impact their safety and recovery. So going further, we know eating disorders can be complex as they affect not only our mental well-being, but can also affect our physical health. Therefore, we need to assess and consider medical concerns. And we acknowledge that this is a lot for folks. So that is where that piece of the client feeling supported is so important.
I don't think very many people consider the physical like repercussions of certain behaviors. So it's, now having Barb, our nurse practitioner, on the team, I think has really highlighted like the need to or the urgency to address those things for sure. So how has maybe the profile of the average person seeking help changed over the last few years?
So I would say one shift that I've seen in recent years is really the increase in people seeking help for ARFID. So ARFID being avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. I know that you spoke with Heather on a previous podcast about ARFID. So in the past, many individuals with ARFID weren't really recognized within the eating disorder system, or even if they were, there wasn't a lot of treatment for it. So these experiences were often maybe even dismissed as like picky eating, anxiety, sensory issues, things like that, rather than understood as a treatable eating disorder. And I think what changed is awareness. So clinicians, families, schools, all of that is kind of more familiar with ARFID. So people are now being identified and referred to for support to BANA. It also helped broaden the public's understanding that not all eating disorders are driven by body image. Some rooted in sensory sensitivities, fear of choking or vomiting, a very limited range of safe foods that are maybe affecting our nutrition. So the profile is definitely expanding in many ways that reflects better recognition of the different ways eating disorders can present themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I mean, I know we just talked to Heather about this like 2 months ago, but just in a couple of years from starting at BANA to now, the shift in awareness about ARFID has changed so much. I feel like the clinical training our team has done on ARFID has, improved the care that they're able to provide because I talk about this every day, but just reminding people that eating disorders don't have a look. I think when people think of an eating disorder, they think of like a young woman. But I just want, maybe you can just, back me up a little bit in reminding people that there really is no one look, age, gender, background, right? Like it affects everyone.
Absolutely. Another thing I want to add to that age, gender, background is weight. We don't need to have a BMI that is super low to have an eating disorder. That is a stigma. There are individuals that do, but I would say most people coming into the office are not what we might think of as a standard kind of stereotypical look for an eating disorder. So I think that also ties into that. I don't know if I'm sick enough to access treatment for eating disorders. If it's impacting your daily living, help is warranted. So there is no look. You're absolutely correct in saying that. I see all different kinds of people coming in, and all of them, again, warranted for getting help, diagnosis, and treatment.
Yeah, thank you for saying that specifically, because that is another, I don't look like I have an eating disorder, because maybe things that we see in the media or in movies, things like that, there is no one look, and I appreciate you saying that. So if if someone is listening to this podcast and they think they need help, so how do they start and what does the intake process look like? Can we break it down? I'm sure it can be overwhelming. Maybe you can break it down simply.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. Sometimes the intake process, it has a lot of moving parts to it. The reason it does, right, is we really want to get a good, clear picture of how the eating is impacting the individual so we can best support you when it comes to treatment planning. So the way I like to break it down is kind of into three parts. We have that self-assessment, the LOXA that we spoke about earlier. So that's your starting point. You'll begin with the recovery support program. It's an anonymous online tool. You just access recoverysupportontario.ca. You can find it also on our website under intake services. You sign up and complete the LOXA. Once that's done, you'll get a bunch of recommendations by email. Our team is also notified so that we can then follow up with you. And you can also, if you want, you can explore those self-guided supports while you wait. After completing that, if the LOXA determines that outpatient treatment looks like a good fit for you, we will ask you to see your primary care provider, have them send us a referral, and complete recent blood work and ECG within the last 3 months. Once we receive everything, our nurse reviews it and triages your file. Self-assessment, primary care referral, ECG, blood work. Once I receive all those on my end, I'll have our nurse practitioner take a look. And then once she triages, outpatient looks appropriate and safe, we will contact you to then book that psychosocial assessment. So everything looks good. Assessment process starts. There will be three appointments: the psychosocial assessment, a physical exam, a follow-up appointment. So the psychosocial assessment, you and I would meet, kind of go over psychosocial functioning. Then the physical exam, Barb and the individual would then meet. After that's done, Barb and I meet, go over both the assessments, kind of go over them with the team, talk about treatment planning. We have a plan. I meet with the individual, we go over that plan. And from there, depending on what's recommended, you may be placed on a wait list and then contacted when a spot opens up.
I love how you broke that down. That really works for my brain, that step-by-step approach.
Yeah.
What if I can already hear someone maybe saying, like, what if they don't have a primary care provider? Or what if they maybe don't feel comfortable having that conversation or a referral?
Yeah, so we actually are partnered with Canadian Mental Health Association, so CMHA. If you don't have a primary care provider, we are always happy to take a referral from them as well, from one of their medical professionals. And then we can stay in the loop and updating them with where you're at in terms of services. If you aren't comfortable with going to CMHA as well, I always encourage you to contact the office. And myself and our nurse practitioner, Barb, can always kind of come up with a plan and see what we can do to make sure that you feel well supported and also safe.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really important. And I'm also thinking, what might the situation be where someone isn't, it isn't appropriate that for them to pursue outpatient therapy? Are they too sick? Like, would something be off with their labs? Like, what would that situation look like?
Yeah, so oftentimes in those situations, we would definitely see some indicators that might suggest that higher level of care and that outpatient would be one, it wouldn't be ethical, it wouldn't be safe, and it wouldn't be appropriate. Our goal is always to make sure that we can pursue treatment with you safely. We know that eating disorders can come along with medical complexities and some require around-the-clock care. Some of those might include if we have a low heart rate, So maybe our heart is beating at lower than 50 beats per minute. There might be some indicators in your blood work as well. There could also be a BMI of lower than 16.5. So the cutoff for outpatient treatment is a BMI of 16.5. Anything lower than that would require hospitalization. The reason being, if someone were to come into treatment and we kind of start in that first initial process of treatment, that mechanical and regular eating, it puts folks at risk for something that's called refeeding syndrome. And that can be really, really dangerous. And I always am trying not to scare anybody, but eating disorders can be deadly. It's just sort of the matter of fact, but they can. So we again wanting just to make sure that everyone is safe in the process of when they are starting their recovery, that that's in an environment that can be monitored around the clock.
Absolutely. And I think thank you again for saying that they are the mental, well, they are the mental health diagnosis, the second highest mortality rate right now, right? I don't think people, a lot of people understand the seriousness or the complications of that. But that's also, they may need higher levels of care, and then when it's properly managed, they can come back to band. It's not like you go into a higher level of care and then can never seek outpatient treatment later. It's more of a sidestep before, getting what you need medically until you're well enough to pursue outpatient. Is that right?
Absolutely. And that's what we're kind of doing in terms of that pathway with the hospital is instead of more of an inpatient setting where someone might be there for a long amount of time, more so getting what we call like medical stabilization until they could then come to an outpatient treatment setting.
Yeah. And then I'm also thinking, what about someone who maybe is also dealing with depression or substance use disorder? Like, how do you navigate what is treated first, I guess?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. So, in terms of folks coming into BANA, I would say I know that we do have an actual number, like statistic-wise, but I would say more often than not, people coming through do have comorbid disorders, that meaning more than one thing happening. So the eating disorder, oftentimes we see generalized anxiety, major depressive disorder. So those kinds of things, I never want to scare anyone off and thinking, hey, if I have this, I can't access treatment. There are times though where there might be things going on in a person's life that require us to make recommendations, and we're always here to help with either referral process, giving you recommendations to take care of that before entering treatment. But I kind of talked a little bit about before how big of a time commitment treatment can be. It requires a lot of motivation. It is a treatment program. So we want to make sure that you can engage in it as successfully as possible so that it's effective. Our goal, right, is always to make sure that folks coming through are hopefully able to leave here with a reduction in symptoms or full remission of the eating disorder. So sometimes in, I'm just trying to think of an example. If someone is maybe struggling with substance use to a point where it would interfere with treatment, we might want to make that referral and making sure they can access treatment for that before coming in for the eating disorder. Same with, I've had someone come in before who was experiencing homelessness. Again, wanting to make sure that that was the priority. Our housing is always a priority. We want to make sure that person is connected before coming into the treatment program and continuing on.
Thank you for sharing that example because I don't think people realize that housing is does affect your health and, is a I mean, we could go have a whole separate podcast about this, but to have the
Yes.
security of homing and whatever that looks like for you, right, does impact both your mental and physical health. So, always thank you. Always a some learning something new from you. Okay, bit of a switch now. Is there a story or a specific instance where Banna has helped someone in particular with an eating disorder that's really stood out for you?
Oh, there's so many. But something that always makes me really excited is just hearing people talk about attending like social gatherings with their friends and family, enjoying them and feeling really excited about it rather than really anxious and overwhelmed. So if we think of a social situation, they often revolve around food. There's usually food involved. If we're going to hang out with our friends, maybe we're going to grab coffee, we're going to a family Christmas dinner, things like that. This can be incredibly distressing for someone with an eating disorder. If we don't have an eating disorder, we wouldn't even really think about that. We're just going out for coffee with friends, right? So when someone shares that they were able to join a meal, go to a party, again, go to that coffee outing and have a sense of normalcy and fun. It's such a powerful reminder of the impact that these programs have because this is something that we deal with every day, just like interacting with our loved ones, when we can have, again, a sense of normalcy and joy around that. That is always something really exciting to see clients finally have that relief and actually enjoy themselves doing these things.
Yeah, I like that you use that example because I feel like we take these things for granted of just being able to go out and enjoy or celebrate with people that we care about and not having to think about it for the most part. That is certainly a privilege I feel like many people, including myself, don't appreciate enough. It happens a lot. Like when I think any type of, I mean, I'm Italian, anything. It's a Tuesday, we're celebrating with food, right? So, and we often have a conversation when we're out doing presentations in the community. Like we are forced in a way to interact with food every single day for the most part, right? It's not something that, oh, I'll just like stay away from maybe another type of substance where I don't have to, purchase a certain substance. I don't have to be around people who are using it. But food is so much more complicated than that.
For
So.
sure, for sure. Yeah, and just thinking like how often food is incorporated into these things, going out for lunch with your friend shouldn't be a daunting, panic-inducing experience. It should be full of like laughter and fun and again, normalcy. So to hear people kind of like throughout treatment being like, yeah, I went for coffee with my friend. I wasn't comparing myself to what they got either. We just kind of had coffee. And that's always something really, really exciting to hear.
I love it. Thank you. So, if our listeners could only take away three simple facts about the intake process or eating disorder treatment in general, what would they be?
So first I had already kind of touched on this, but it's safe and judgment-free conversation. So a lot of people coming in are really worried that they're going to be judged. And again, that not sick enough, which kind of ties into as well as eating disorders not having a look. If it's affecting you, then it's affecting you. You deserve treatment. So when intake is really just like that supportive, collaborative space where we can talk about things like that. And it also is a nice space that we can talk about any of your mental health supports and figure out next steps together. The goal is really, again, for you to be heard and understood, not evaluated or criticized. Two, something I always like to tell people as well is this is completely voluntary. You're in control, you're in the driver's seat, so you can stop the process at any time. If you just want to pick up the phone and have a quick conversation and that's it, totally fine. During the psychosocial assessment, you can even take breaks. You can choose when what you feel comfortable sharing. You can ask questions along the way. You can do all your assessments and change your mind afterwards, and that's totally okay. You can stop the process even if you're halfway through treatment, if you're like, hey, I don't think I'm ready to do this. Again, totally okay. You're in control. This is your process, and you get to move it at a pace that feels manageable for you.
We always remind people too, like even if you stop, you come back. Like even if you finish your whole treatment program and something happens and you're going back to certain behaviors, like we want you to come back and seek treatment, right? So just
For
wanna,
sure.
that was more for like me putting it out there that absolutely it's okay to stop or not move forward, and you can always come back.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. Even if, right, you didn't finish treatment, you didn't get through the whole assessment process, always come back. We have folks coming back all the time and it's no problem at all.
Awesome. Okay, sorry to cut you off. Number three.
No, you're good. So number three, I would say maybe again, kind of tying back to that sick enough, you can start now, right? You don't have to wait until things feel too serious. If anything, it's better to start sooner than later. So it really just begins again with that simple self-assessment that we talked about on the recovery support program, followed by those referrals and then a more in-depth assessment if appropriate. And even if there's a wait list, there's those supports like those self-guided modules and peer groups available right away. So you're not doing this alone. But yeah, at the end of the day, the sooner you can get help, usually the better your treatment outcome is going to be as well. So things don't have to be serious enough. I actually encourage to come before they may get serious. I guess that's sort of my thoughts on maybe some three things that might be good to know about the intake process.
Those were perfect. That was great. I'm thinking, based on a conversation I had with someone in the community, so anyone can call your 1-855 number if they have questions. But what if someone, because there is that wait list, let's say there's another service provider in the community who's working with someone who is on a wait list, how can they support their clients? Like, obviously, they're not going to support them with eating disorder or behaviors, but is there something that those providers can do in the interim until their client can begin treatment? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so I would say, of course, always like providing them the resources of those peer support groups, the recovery support program. I as well am always happy to talk with providers. Maybe even if they provide consent, talking a little bit about the client, if they've already even gone through the assessment process as well. And kind of having that circle of care where we can have these discussions on. We both have an understanding of the client, what does support look like for them? And I'm always happy to provide any additional resources in that regard and just sort of seeing where the client's at and how we can meet them there.
That's great. Thank you. I know it's hard. Community programs do so much work, often filling gaps, right? In care, and everyone's just trying their best to support people in the community. So it's nice when organizations can work together. Okay, so where can our listeners find more information about intake at BANA?
I would say honestly, the best place is our website, www.bana.ca. It's packed full of helpful information. It has information on the intake process, what treatment looks like, a lot of FAQ sections, along with resources not only for individuals, but caregivers as well. And it's really your go-to hub for everything that you need to get started. Yeah, lots of information on there.
Thanks for sharing the piece about the caregiver resource, because I don't know how many people realize that we do have that information of how to support your loved one. All right. One of my last questions here, Alicia, if someone is listening right now, they have their hand on their phone, they're wondering if they should dial Banna's number, what's the one thing they need to know about what's on the other side of the call?
So I would say on the other side of the call, if you're wondering, should I call? Most important thing to know is you're going to be met with kindness. Again, not judgment. On the other end is on the line is someone who genuinely wants to listen to you. I think everyone that kind of enters social work positions because they genuinely care and want to strengthen the community and help others in their lives. They genuinely want to listen to you and understand where you're at. I always want to walk alongside you at your own pace. So you don't have to have everything figured out when you pick up the phone. You don't have to say the right thing. Just reaching out is enough. I'll meet you exactly where you're at when you call me, whether that's just having some idea about some resources or whether it's getting started, I will meet you where you're at. Again, with kindness, no judgment. I'm here to help you.
Amazing. Alicia, you are you when if you haven't met Alicia before, she is always calm. She is so knowledgeable and just genuinely like you can feel how much you care. And so I just want people to know that, like, if you haven't met her, this is, who you're interacting with. And I hope that makes you feel like supported, right? Whoever's listening in that moment, and you're in very, 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 very good hands. So thank you, Alicia, for taking the time to join me today. I know so many folks in the community, whether that, maybe a person struggling or a caregiver or another provider, will find this conversation helpful and maybe open their eyes to all the work that goes on behind the scenes and how thorough the intake process is. You talked about those three steps. That's a really holistic picture of someone's well-being and is so important and so necessary. So for those listening, if you're interested in learning more about eating disorders in Windsor, Essex, please find us on our socials at Banna Windsor, our website, banna.ca, or read more in the Banna Be Yourself magazine. Thanks for joining us and see you next time. And thank you, Alicia.
Thank you.